Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
This podcast was produced Thursday, October 2nd at 6 o'clock p.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this. Yeah, like Republicans and Democrats will both accept equal blame for the federal government shutdown. Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics, at all those Snollygosters, those shrewd politicians who never compromise until they do. I'm Mike Thompson. Coming up in the podcast, a recommendation to form another working group. But first, it is a politics and a pint edition of Snollygoster. Like we did in August, we gathered about 200 of our closest friends at Seventh Sun Brewing here in Columbus, and we talked politics while enjoying craft beers. Joining me were WOSU's Amy Jurevich, Ohio Public Radio's Joe Ingles, and Signal Statewide's Jake Zuckerman. Like the wide selection of Seventh Sun's IPAs, the discussion had notes of fruit, pine, and just the right amount of bitterness. Here it is.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to WOSU's Politics and a Pint. Welcome to Seventh Sun Brewing. Here we are. And as is the case in the mid-2020s, as far as politics are concerned, it is hard to keep up. I don't know how y'all do it, I don't know how we do it, but it's hard to keep up. As you may have heard, the federal government is shut down, at least partially. President Trump wants to send National Guard troops to even more cities than Washington, D.C. and Memphis, Tennessee. We are still dealing with the fallout from the murder of Charlie Kirk. That seems like it was so long ago. It was just a couple of weeks. Here in Ohio, the field for the U.S. Senate race is set. The field for governor is almost set. Still a little bit of uncertainty on the Democratic side. Governor DeWine's working group on property taxes is out with its recommendations. Spoiler alert, ain't nothing bold in there. So don't look for your tax bills to go down anytime soon. Also, we are drawing congressional maps again, and the redistricting process is underway. And of course, residents of German Village now say they are suing the city because the accessible ramps from the sidewalk down to the street are not historically compliant. Any German Village residents here? You know what? Finally, we can make fun of a different neighborhood than my home city of Dublin. So there you go. So apparently bumpy rubber mats are not historically compliant with what the German immigrants had in mind 150 years ago. So many controversies, so little beer. Actually, there is plenty of beer, so get to that. All right, let's get into it. Amy Jurevich, government shutdowns at one point were rare. Now they seem to happen every 5-6 years or so. Frankly, I'm kind of surprised they don't happen more often. Given our climate, I would expect these to happen once every 6 months, once a year. Who's to blame?
Oh, you're going to give me that question. Who's yes. to blame? Everyone is to blame. I think that we're in a situation where nothing is surprising, so the government shutting down seemed expected and also surprising, and nothing is surprising at the same time. I know that Joe's colleague, was it you or Sarah Donaldson who talked to the governor? I can't remember. You did. Okay, Joe talked to the governor, so she can talk about that. But the government shutdown, it's going to impact people several days from now. You know, like right now, whenever it first happens and everyone is just thinking like, oh, I don't really know what's going on. Will I get my flight? Will my mail be delivered? You know, all those questions will get answered. And yes, your mail's being delivered. Flights are still there. But it's what happens a couple weeks from now. That's what happened last time. The shutdown went for more than 30 days. And air traffic controllers and people who work for the TSA, they kind of, or who made it stop because they worked for a month with no pay and then said, that's enough. And once the air traffic slowed down and stopped, that's when people really started noticing and calling their congresspeople and saying, why is my flight canceled? What are you doing? So I think it's a matter of time when people start to notice, but right at this second, I'm not sure how many people are noticing.
Yeah, your Social Security checks, Medicare claims are being processed. It's new applications. If you call the Social Security office or Medicare office, you want to make a new application, have a question, you might run into problems. Jake, you know, the party in charge now is the Republicans. They're blaming the Democrats, of course. Democrats blame Republicans. You could argue that both are to blame at this point.
Just like a quick break. Congress is supposed to pass 12, I think, or so spending bills. They're must-pass bills. They're spectacularly bad at it as an institution. They never do it. They pass continuing resolutions. We just continue funding government at whatever level it was at the day before. So these, we constantly, the last one was 2018. We've had a bunch of near misses since then. Right now, Republicans control the House. Simple majority clears the House. Republicans control the presidency. Obviously, one-man vote. 50-some Republicans in the Senate. You need 60 votes to pass anything. So like seven Democrats are shutting this down. The Democrats are saying that how can you be a part of this? You know, like we are sending National Guard troops into American cities. We have masked ICE agents running rampant, you know, doing everything from deporting people to showing up at Gavin Newsom's political rallies just to be what looks like a show of intimidation. So I think Democrats are saying, we will not vote to fund this government if it continues to fund this way. And they're saying that they want They're also, the messaging's getting a little muddier because they're also saying that they want enhanced premiums that fund Obamacare plans. Those are going to go away. Anyone who's getting insurance through the Affordable Care Act, you're going to see huge price increases without that. But so who's to blame? I don't know. Everyone, Congress, nobody, all of us?
Yeah, because in March, Joe, the Senate, basically the House voted along party lines to shut down the government and not fund the budget. And it was Chuck Schumer who said, this isn't the battle we want to fight right now. We're going to vote for it to continue the government till now. This time they're holding firm. And that's because the base, so we got a little smattering there of a sample, want Democrats to fight back, right?
Exactly. I mean, the polling is showing that. And that's what we're seeing in Ohio. I mean, a lot of people in Ohio at the State House and the people who come testify at the State House, they're fighting back right now on redistricting. They're fighting back. So we're seeing a lot of that. And as Amy mentioned, the governor is kind of, sitting here looking at the shutdown saying, we didn't want to shut down, but right now everything's okay, and give it a couple weeks. Right now we're just in the talking stage. So I think we're kind of at a wait and see point.
Yeah. I always say that in the past they've always come this close and they've reached a deal, like we did last March. This time you kind of got the feeling they were not going to reach a compromise until the shutdown came. The budget process in the state is very different. Every 2 years we have a budget. It's balanced, and we never have we have fights, but of course it helps to have Republicans in control now, so there is no real debate, but the budget process here is much different than the federal process. Why is that?
Well, I'd add there that we almost had a shutdown in Ohio. House Speaker Larry Householder refused to pass a budget, and Ohio, in what was probably the first time in state history, had to pass a continuing resolution, and we later learned that that was a pressure play that was part of a bribery scheme that sent him to prison. But for the record.
So maybe the key is threat of prison will prevent shutdown.
There would never be another shutdown.
There we go. So anyway, National Guard troops. Amy, they're now, I guess, Portland. It was today. He's planning on sending troops. The president's planning on sending troops to Portland, Oregon. Whether the governor or the mayor of Portland, governor of Oregon or the mayor of Portland wants them or not, they're in D.C., Memphis, Tennessee. This has not been, it started out really controversial, but the pushback, at least among most people, doesn't seem to be as vigorous as it was when it started.
I feel like people are losing interest in that. They've moved on to the next thing. Yes, National Guard is being sent here and there, but then Jimmy Kimmel gets canceled for a week, and so that's where the attention goes. It's like, what's the next shiny new thing? And whenever you hear that there's National Guard members going to Portland, you think, like, what is wrong with this? What is wrong with this? Is there a run on bookstores? Are all of the little, like, kitty cat cafes having a problem? Like, you don't think of Portland having these problems. So I think most people are just saying, I don't understand what's going on. Now, you know, to be fair, they're sending troops to, is it Nashville, Memphis?
Memphis, Tennessee.
I feel like there's just too much going on, and so people either are looking at the next shiny thing or completely tuning out now because they are having an issue with too much news, too fast, and it's too heavy, and they're done.
This all seems to be a reaction to social media, to video. Crime rates in cities are going down, but there was a carjacking in D.C. with a member of the DOGE staff, got a lot of attention. There was a fight in Cincinnati was an awful, awful fight in Cincinnati that went all over social media. That's what's prompting a lot of this, you know, reaction to crack down on crime in cities.
Can I add something here?
Sure, please.
Okay. I have a theory here. I think that there is, I live out in the suburbs. I grew up in the sticks in Fayette County. It's a heavy agricultural manufacturing area. And it is not Columbus, right? And so I am around a lot of people, ordinary people, who think that Columbus has this massive crime problem. Because out in their area of the world, they don't have a lot of murders. They don't see a lot of crime on the TV set. They don't see a lot happening in their world that looks like crime. So when they turn on the TV or they hear about murders in a city, they kind of react differently.
Yep.
So when the president says something about going to cities to control crime, they're drawing the conclusion based on a lot of times what they've seen or heard. And just real quickly, I went to a meat market out in the country 3 months ago. And as I was checking out, this girl says, oh, you live near Columbus. And I said, yeah, I live in Powell. And she says, oh, I hear the crime is just awful down there.
In Powell?
It's Columbus. It's Columbus, you know? She's thinking that I live in this high crime area. And I just, you know, I sat there and I thought about that. My husband thought about that. And we talked about it on the way home. There are people who do not have the same perspective as probably most of the people sitting in this room. And they haven't been to Columbus a lot. They don't come down here. And so their image that they have in their mind of a city sometimes is very, very different than what we all think of.
Yeah, but in a lot of cases, perception is reality. Chicago, for instance, safest summer in 25 years, the city claims. Murder rate, assault rates way down, Jake. But in the first 6 months of this year, 192 murders. That's a lot of murders, and it's the, quote, safest summer in 25 years. So crime is a problem, and a lot of the residents in some of these neighborhoods in D.C., Memphis, maybe Portland, maybe Chicago, the South Side, West Side, are going to say, you know what? I don't mind the National Guard troops.
See, I've thought there's a split in the conversation here. Everyone uses the term crime, and I think they're usually referring to violent crime, which is way, way down, but I think what they're really talking about is disorder. Like, if you remember J.D. Vance getting kind of heckled at Union Station in D.C., he said crime is out of control, but then he went on to talk about homeless people, you know, immigrants who have been sent to D.C. who came here illegally. They're awaiting hearings that are going to be in years, so they're just sort of sent to these cities with nowhere to go, and social services can't really absorb them and provide care. Mental illness, you know, like when you just see someone walking down the street and yelling. So these things aren't, they're not really crime, they're disorder, but that seems to be the impetus that's really driving it. And then there's also the politics of the fact that, like, these Republicans don't live in these cities, by and large. The cities are all Democrats, so it's not like they're going to lose many votes there. Mm-hmm. And, like, look in D.C., like, Ohio just sent the National Guard there. The federal government's paying for that. We're not paying for it. Mike DeWine has taken this position that, well, I'm not going to send the National Guard here, but I'll send them there, and someone else is footing the bill. So the incentives are all warped, and everyone's just kind of along for the ride. And not, but at the bottom of it, none of these cities want the guard there, with one exception, I think, in this whole country.
Yeah, I think Memphis was, they were at least less resistant to having the guard there. And the guard, thankfully, as Ohioans know, National Guard and civilians can have tragic results. We haven't had that. The Guard has not really been fighting crime in D.C. anyway. They've been basically guarding tourist attractions, doing, I think some of them have been doing chores.
I'll add one more thing. I talked to a professor who studies crime statistics, and she basically told me that we should stop gathering crime statistics. She studies it for a living, and she said that they are, for the most part, worthless, because how every different city, you know, check marks whether it's a violent crime or not, and what gets tracked and how it gets tracked, and whether the person who was the victim, whether they file something or not or pull the file, like, she basically just said the crime stats are not worth the time and energy that are put into it, and she would rather see the people who spend all that time doing crime statistics figuring out why the crime is occurring and doing something to solve that. And she was talking more about social issues, mental health issues, homelessness, rather than dealing with the crime statistics.
Yeah, Joe Moss, who's a panelist on Columbus on the Record, said, don't forget, police are law enforcement, which means a crime has already occurred. You're enforcing the law, trying to arrest somebody who has committed a crime. It's not crime prevention. That's a deeper problem that requires much more complex solutions. Political rhetoric. I think it's calmed down. I hope it's calmed down over the past few weeks. We had the murder of Charlie Kirk, which was horrific. It was on video, and I think a lot of people saw it. It was in front of 3,000 people. He was a very controversial figure. And usually after something like that, after Trump's first assassination attempt, there wasn't a whole lot of finger pointing. People came together a little bit. That did not happen this time, Joe.
No. The Charlie Kirk Memorial up in Dublin a couple of weeks ago, my colleague Sarah Donaldson covered that. And there were elements that appeared to be more like a political rally than an actual vigil. But, you know, we're seeing a deep division. And, you know, you were talking about things simmering down, but, you know, let's be real. Down at the State House, they're going through redistricting right now. And political rhetoric, you know, that's the name of the game down there. And so it's just simmering. I think it's simmering on a hot pad right now, and it hasn't boiled over yet, but, you know, give it time.
How much do you blame, Jake, social media for this? I shan't X. I used to be I shan't Twitter, now I shan't X. It's such a trap. And you get on there and it's an echo chamber and it's people with very small ideas with very loud voices, but they go viral. And like three or four people can say something really mean and nasty, and all of a sudden it's on Fox News, it's on the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and that's, so all of a sudden everybody thinks that Charlie Kirk deserved to die, which only maybe a few people said that.
I'm of split minds about it. Like, on the one hand, yeah, engagement is enragement, or the other way around, however that expression goes, and the worst of us seems to be what rises on social media. The flip side is that it feels kind of cheap to just blame, you know, if we blame social media, then if we get rid of social media, our problems are solved and we all get along, and I think anyone in this room would just roll their eyes at that sentiment. You know, like, what 74 million Americans voted for Donald Trump. I don't think you can just say that that's because of Facebook.
No, I
don't buy it.
But I think the immediate reaction to certain events and how certain things can get blown way out of proportion, I think social media amplifies in those instances in the immediate aftermath.
I'll say one thing that strikes me about the Charlie Kirk assassination and then this very obvious crackdown on free speech that has emanated from it is most. Yeah, you know, Jimmy Kimmel lost his job because of comments that he made on a network TV show with like 200 staffers, and you know Jimmy Kimmel's going to be fine. Most of the people that got fired, like your teachers, your cops, like A, you know, these are working class people who are out of their jobs, and B, almost all the statements were made on social media. Yep. I don't know exactly what to make of that, but that's where, like, no, these weren't comments to the newspaper, these weren't thought out editorials, these were usually like Facebook posts and tweets that cost people their jobs.
Yeah, I mean, we all have social media policies at work. Those, you know, and we have them at, you know, to some degree at WOSU, at Ohio State. And, you know, the First Amendment says your right to speech will not be infringed, but it doesn't say your employer can make no rule. And that's what's happening.
Yeah. I mean, it does make me worried about free speech, because if you have free speech, you have the right to say whatever you want to say, but there's no protection from the consequences that happen after you say what you say. So then, therefore, are people going to not say anything because they're worried? And what happens if politicians stop saying things because they're worried about getting canceled or whatever? Like, if people stop talking and dialoguing and saying what's on their mind, then the echo chamber gets louder, or does it get quieter? I'm not really sure what happens. I mean, one of the greatest parts of this country is supposed to be free speech, that you can say what you want to say and you're protected, but it feels like you're not. Like, you can say whatever you want to say, but then someone who you thought was your friend on Facebook is going to do a screenshot of it and send it to your boss? That is just not the same.
What do you guys make of cancel culture? Because back in 2020, it was going the other way. A lot of liberals were calling out conservatives, what they were saying on Facebook, and folks were losing their job. Now it's the other way. I mean, it just doesn't seem like a very, in some ways, maybe it makes people think twice about what they're saying. But on the other hand, it does infringe. Does it infringe on their, does it stifle conversation?
I think there's a way to have conversation without having all the controversy. I mean, honestly, we have lost a sense of civility. No one knows, or it seems few know how to get on social media and actually have a conversation. And I know, even putting up just factual information about something, I can put up something about voting laws and how we're doing voting in Ohio, and immediately it will turn into a bunch of people going after each other over politics. And it's like, this is not political. This is a fact-based thing. And I think we've got a situation where we no longer have the civility to talk to one another, and we always suspect the worst in one another. But, you know, I can tell you that I think a lot of people who I might disagree with on a lot of things, you know, when you get together and you talk, you find out that there is room for agreement.
Yeah.
And I think we're losing that.
Do you, back to this free speech thing, I know when I'm, you know, I think as journalists, we're all very careful. I've seen so many people get sent to prison for what's in their text messages. I don't put a damn thing in a text message. I mean, look at all the people who go to jail because they're texting all these crazy things to their buddies, figure no one's ever going to see them again. I don't put anything in a text message that I don't want the world to see. But, and so that's my personal life, but as a journalist, you're careful. But I found even over the past month, I don't think it's stifling what I've been reporting, but I've given my copy an extra look to make sure that I'm being fair, that I'm being accurate, that I'm not using hyperbolic language. I'm saying conservative activists, not right-wing activists. I think the right wing is loaded, so let's call it conservative. Are you guys doing the same?
I speak on live radio for 8 hours every week, and I have never been, I try to be so careful, but I have to be so careful, and I have never been so worried as to what did I just say. I don't know what words came out of my mouth, in what order, did they come out the correct way. I don't have time to go back and listen to all of my shows to make sure that I said every word in the right order, and yeah, that's scary. It's scary.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it's for journalists, it's good. You know, to make sure that we are being measured and fair and accurate and things like that.
I always try to be fair. I always try to get all of the sides of a story. And I must mention that my boss, Karen Kassler, the bureau chief, is over here. And she looks through our copy. She looks through our copy. We often look through her copy.
How does that work out?
It works out well.
All right.
Yeah. You know, she's here. You know, I'm censoring my speech.
No, wouldn't you like to be able to critique your boss? That'd be great, wouldn't it?
No, but seriously, it's, you know, having another set of eyes on the copy is always a good thing. And, you know, I think that's, we don't think about that enough. And we also don't think that sometimes the words you say, you might not mean something out of it, but someone else will take it that way. And so we have to be really careful.
The other side of that is we can be too cautious in not calling out falsehoods, not calling out things that are without context. So where is that balance, Jake?
I think all of us would be well served these days to speak your mind. If someone has been killed, give it a day or two. But speak your mind. Speak freely. I mean that at all, like all over the place. I feel like Democratic politicians are clearly so frightened to just speak their mind these days. And you just get this, it's like four consultants like run a crank and just like, you just hear all these words and it just.
But what about the Republican politicians who are worried about saying something that's going to make President Trump unhappy? Because then they lose their job.
Well, to give you one, to put a face to it, Lisa Murkowski, I mean, how long has she been a U.S. senator? She said to the New York Times, I'm afraid to speak my mind because of what might happen to me. That is an insane thing for a U.S. senator to say. I take her at her word that she believes it, but like, that's just a terrifying place to be in. But saying nothing will do nothing.
Just
speak your mind.
The Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is headed by a Georgetown University professor, hardly a conservative bastion, says for the first time in 30 years, left-wing terrorist attacks outnumbered those from the right wing. It's just the age we're in now.
Wait a minute.
Okay. This is a reputable source. This is recent history. So over the past 3 to 4 years, before then it was right wing. Now it's left wing.
What I don't understand is the confidence with which we paint the ideologies of these troubled young men doing these. Can I curse here?
Gently.
Do it. I can't. He's got an FCC license.
And believe me, FCC licenses are very valuable now. Tenuous.
Like I would posit to you, like what? First of all, like the guy who killed Charlie Kirk. I don't know. Nobody in this room has met him. How can anyone confidently speak about what he thinks and feels about the world?
Well, one bullet said, "Catch fascist."
Did it? Did the bullet even say that?
Okay, but that's what the evidence shows, and we will follow.
What evidence? There hasn't been a trial. I mean, I think we should not just go picking up these loose strands of evidence that come out in media reports or from an FBI director who's proven willing to just sort of lie to the public or at least speak way prematurely about events. Someone who's 19 years old, A, has an undeveloped political ideology. Like, how many? I believed all kinds of dumb stuff at 19 that I would, like, I wish I had nothing to do with now. That's part of being a 19-year-old. And if you're ill enough to think that assassinating someone because you don't like their political outlook is a good idea, then, like, you have an incoherent mind to track.
Right.
I would like to see the questions in that Georgetown study, to be quite honest, because
But would you guys question the Georgetown study if it found the opposite? That's my question.
I think I would want to see the questions anyway.
Okay.
I think there's a lot
They're tracking incidents. They're not asking questions. They're tracking incidents. But it was on Point yesterday, if you want to listen to it, if any of you heard it, On Point on our stations at noon, weekdays. They did a whole show on this. And it was a really good discussion. And she challenged the methodology, and he stuck by his numbers. You know, is it a huge gap? I don't know. But anyway.
Yeah, I think the thing is that oftentimes we see something like that quoted, and we don't see what led to that. And I, as a journalist, I want to know what the question was. I want to know what the context is, because there's just way too much stuff coming out of context.
What defines a terrorist attack? Yeah. I mean, in charges in New York, the healthcare CEO who was killed, originally it was a terrorist attack, and then the judge recently said, no, it was a terrible murder, but it wasn't a terrorist attack. Let's move on to something more pleasant.
German Village Bricks?
Huh?
German Village Bricks?
Oh, yes. No. The rubber mats with the bumps. Anyway, we have those in Dublin, by the way, and they're fine. 2026 race, it's only October of 25. So we're getting there. I mean, our election day is a month away. And then after that, the race really will pick up because the filing deadline for candidates is in February. The primaries are in May. So we can really start to talk about the 2026 race in earnest. Big news is in the governor's race. Jim Tressel is out. I see we have some Michigan fans, perhaps. Tattoo fans? I don't know. Who else?
But imagine
maybe you're opposed to his fitness regime. Maybe that's what it is.
He would turn the temperature down and put on a sweater vest, and everything would be.
Anyway, Vivek Ramaswamy looks like he will be the eventual Republican candidate. Amy Acton continues to campaign very hard, but now we are all waiting for Tim Ryan. Jake, what is the word on Tim Ryan? It was supposed to be September 30th. It's now October 2nd. When are we going to get his decision on whether he runs or not?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, this is like my least favorite game in politics is the will he, won't he announce a campaign.
Ditto.
He recently said something.
Let's do it anyway.
His spokesman said in a few days he'll make a decision. My colleague had a nice little rundown of how that was different from like a month ago when he said he's really nearing a decision. And a month before that, we're this close, guys. We're this close. I don't know. I don't know what Tim Ryan's going to do. How could I know?
The bottom line is politicians don't run for office if they don't think they can win. Right? I mean, they would like to spend more time with their family. I understand.
Tim Ryan ran for president.
I know. Well, he was trying to make a name for himself to run for Senate. So there is an alternate strategy. But what do you think is going to happen, Joe? Do you think Tim Ryan, he lives here in Central Ohio now. He's got a consulting lobbyist business, to use the dirty L word. He's got some client base, family. He's coaching his kids in sports. Does he jump in this race or does he stay where he is?
I don't know. I really, truly don't know.
Amy Acton, will she settle for lieutenant governor if he offers her that?
No. She told me she is running to be governor, and she's not living in a world of what ifs. But I do think that Tim Ryan taking his sweet old time to decide about deciding is impacting her campaign. It's causing her to not be able to raise as much money as she could. She's not getting some endorsements that she needs. Vivek Ramaswamy is way out ahead of her in fundraising and endorsements and media attention because everyone's waiting for Tim Ryan to make a decision. So I think he is holding her back.
In normal times, October of the year before the election would not be late. It's just, it shows you the nonstop campaign we're in now.
Well, I'd also like to point out that there are two top positions statewide that the Democrats don't have a candidate in either one of those positions. So, I mean, you know, that kind of says something right there.
Who's the better candidate to run against, from a Democratic perspective, who is the better candidate to run against Vivek Ramaswamy? Amy Acton, we all know who she is. She has decent name ID, but she's a political newcomer. Tim Ryan, Mahoning Valley, Sherrod Brown-esque type Democrat. Which would be a better candidate to be more competitive against, from a Democratic perspective, against Vivek Ramaswamy, do you think? Jake, who do you...
I mean, Tim Ryan has lost statewide recently. Like, that's... Amy Acton has not. I don't know. It's a tough question to evaluate. I don't know. To me, it's sucks because we're not going to know the answer to this until the primary, but the barometer for where Democrats are is going to come from the Secretary of State primary with Brian Hambly and Allison Russo. Because I think, can we do a straw poll?
Question. Do you know who those people are? Raise your hand. Wow.
Do you know who Brian Hambly? Just Brian Hambly.
Okay, there we go. He's going to work on that name ID.
We're in Columbus, but there. I mean, so I guess everyone knows who Allison Russo is here. She's the She was the House Minority Leader. She was the ranking House Democrat in the Ohio House. She made a big decision to vote for the legislative maps, which is why those are not being redrawn right now. She decided to work with Republicans and take what she called the best of two bad options. And she's taking heat now for it in this primary because people are saying, we want someone who wants to fight with Republicans. And Allison Russo decided to work with Republicans. Democrats got very good political outcomes despite their super minority position during those years. But so that's my, like, do Democrats want someone who's just going to accept the world as it is and work with Republicans a bit? Or do they want someone who's just going to fight and go down fighting, maybe win out?
The bottom line is, Amy, any Republican starts with a 10-point advantage in this state right now. Can anybody make up that 10-point advantage?
It's a big hill to climb up, and I think that's why Joe pointed out there are not people running for a couple of the seats, because I'm not sure that there are Democrats who want to put their name out there to run statewide and lose, right? Because then you get labeled as, you know, your name gets known, but then your name gets known for losing, and losing by, what if you lose by 15, 20, 25%, then that's a big loss. So the Democrats have a lot of room to make up. They need to get their party organized, and they need to figure out whether they're going to just run people or fight more. Yeah.
The unions are ticket splitting, Joe. The plumbers and pipe fitters, they're endorsing Sherrod Brown for U.S. Senate, but they're endorsing Vivek Ramaswamy for governor. The Teamsters, they're endorsing Vivek Ramaswamy for governor. They have not decided yet on the U.S. Senate race. What's going on there?
Well, I honestly haven't talked to the union, so I don't know, okay? But we have seen a lot of union support shift to Republicans because a lot of union people have shifted. If you look at the Mahoning Valley, and that 10 years ago, that was such a strong Democratic stronghold, right? Union families, working people. And that's all shifted to Trump. And I think the one thing we haven't talked about in this discussion right now is the Trump factor. You've got to remember that Vivek Ramaswamy came out early, but he came out on the very same day that Trump gave his endorsement to Vivek Ramaswamy. The president carries a whole lot of weight right now with Republicans, but we have a whole year and months to go. And a lot of things can change in that time. So I think us trying to look at a crystal ball right now, we really can't do that.
Now, Donald Trump will not be on the ballot in 2026, Jake. And if you look at 26, he's only halfway through his term. We'll get to 28 later. Anyway, but when you look at the results, Donald Trump basically did a little bit better vote totals than he did in 2020. The difference was Democrats didn't show up. There's all these stories and they showed that Donald Trump did much better with young African Americans, did much better with Hispanics. But part of that reason, you just look at the percentages, part of the reason why the percentages are off is because a lot of young African Americans didn't vote, a lot of Hispanics didn't vote. What's it going to take to get Democrats to energize what traditionally has been their core constituents?
I mean, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I don't know. I guess what I wonder is, do you have a policy problem? Are the Democrats not offering the right solution, or is it a communications problem? Are they not voicing? In fact, I feel 100% certain that they have a communication. Like, they have a perceptions problem. I mean, I don't know when it happened, but if you remember, like, Barack Obama was cool. Like, do you remember how cool Obama was?
Well, he was a fresh face.
He was the center. He was like this mainstream cultural figure. To me, I mean, I realized.
You could argue so was Donald Trump on that side.
Well, I realized things had really shifted in college football season a year ago. I don't remember what team it was, but someone scored a touchdown and did the dance. They did the Trump dance. And I was just shocked. I'm like, oh my God, like Donald Trump is now cool. Young men are scoring touchdowns and dancing like Donald Trump. So like Democrats need to be cool again. If you look at Democrats' leadership right now,
yeah.
I mean, like, when has Chuck Schumer or Hakeem Jeffries like gotten the will of the people behind them? That to me is what has just been, I haven't seen in the last 8-9 months.
I did a story, not to plug my own story, but the DNC is giving Ohio Democratic Party a substantial amount of money. And the reason they're doing that is they want them to go out and rebuild the infrastructure in Ohio into these small cities, the rural areas, and be able to message 365 days a year. That is something that's missing right now. A lot of small towns, you can't find Democratic Party headquarters because there isn't one. Mm-hmm. And they don't have the level of Democratic events. They don't have, the Democrats have a problem with a farm team right now. They don't have people sitting on the bench waiting to run. And the Democrats are not messaging in those areas as they once did. And so that money is meant to help with that. Whether it does remains to be seen, but it certainly does appear that the Democratic Party is trying some new things. They've got a rural farmer from Shelby County who used to be the head of the Republican Party in Shelby County, and then after Trump won, he became the Democratic head of the Democratic Party in Shelby County, and now he's running this rural initiative, right?
Yep.
And it's statewide. So they are doing some things to try to speak to that.
Yeah, that's the thing, Amy, is that the Democrats have the cities sewn up, but they
that's what I was just going to say. So the rural areas. Yeah. I mean, that's great, and that's a great campaign in the rural areas, but it makes me wonder about the cities. You know, Democrats have a stronghold in Columbus, Cleveland, and Cincinnati. So why aren't there mayors from Cincinnati and Cleveland and members of Columbus City Council who are running for statewide office? Because, I mean, they have the name recognition in at least one city. They could try to run in the state.
Yeah. It comes down to, as I said before, politicians run for office if they think they could win. And Democrats are afraid of getting their butts kicked in a statewide election and being tarred. I mean, look at Nan Whaley, Ed Fitzgerald, solid candidates, mayors, chief executives, big areas, lost very badly. Political career basically stalled severely, at the very least. Let's get on to redistricting, everyone's favorite topic. Map making, we have to do it every year here in Ohio. Most places do it once every 10 years, but we like to do it every year because of court fights and ballot issues and things like that. The process is the first deadline just passed 2 days ago where the lawmakers had to pass a map that both parties agreed to. That didn't happen. Now we're in phase two. Next deadline's about a month. Redistricting Commission, these are the statewide office holders, get together, supposedly draw a map. Will this be a fair map? He asks rhetorically. Well, Republicans will argue it is fair, but because the state, as we said, votes very much Republican. Joe, I'll let you handle this one. You love redistricting.
Yeah, I do follow redistricting, but let's put it this way. There isn't even a Republican map at this point that's been proposed at the State House. And this is a three-phase process. We are now in the second phase of the process. That is the Ohio Redistricting Commission, which is basically made up of a 5-2 Republican lean. And so, you know, we've seen what's happened at the Redistricting Commission before, and it's, you know, you can get a very partisan outcome there. So I don't know. I what we're hearing from lawmakers, they may not come up with a map until November because they really, the last part of the process is the end of November, and they can pass a map along partisan lines in November, and it could be very much to their favor. We're hearing Bernie Moreno, one of the U.S. senators, saying that he would like to have our map right now has 5 Democratic seats and 10 Republican ones. Bernie Moreno wants to have that down to 2 or 3 Democratic seats and the rest Republicans. So, I mean, there are ways that you can configure a map to do anything you want to do. The Republicans are not showing their hands yet, and it's going to be a fight. It is a fight. It's just simmering.
I'll jump in here. The Constitution says that the map they make cannot, quote, unduly favor either political party. How much can you favor a political party before it's an undue amount? That question is ultimately going to go to the Ohio Supreme Court. That Supreme Court used to be 4-3. Now it's, 6-1 Republican. So for the Democrats to win here, like whatever exactly a win is, you need to have 5 Republican Supreme Court justices say, you know what, this is an undue amount of favor to the Republican Party, which helped get me here. The Republican Party, which added partisan labels to ballots, which massively benefited Republican judges. And you know what? This is just undue.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do what ended Maureen O'Connor's career, and I'm going to vote with the Democrats, and that's going to happen with five different... It's just kind of like, does anyone really believe that outcome?
The basic question is, are we going to end up with three relatively safe Democratic seats or just two relatively safe Democratic seats?
I think that's... I don't know which of those two is correct. I think one of them is, and it's like the way Bernie Moreno, like Joe just said, is talking about it. Like they're not hiding what they're doing here. They're saying there are too many Democrats. We should just redraw districts so there are less of them.
And
this,
to
this
point
is very
out,
blunt.
All six New England states, and there are rural conservative areas of New England, but all six New England states, there's not one Republican congressperson up there. So this is not a unique problem to Ohio, and it's not a purely partisan problem across the country. So, property taxes. Amy, I'm going to give you the property tax question.
Oh, joy.
Now, we all had a lot of anticipation for what the governor's working group on property taxes was going to come up with. They came out with their recommendations, I believe, Tuesday, right? The 30th was their deadline. Pretty modest changes. There's a deferral for seniors to help them combat rising property taxes. It's something called the circuit breaker, where if a disproportionate amount of your income is going to your property taxes, you get a break. Other states have that. Ohio doesn't. That's in his recommendations. More transparency. Basically, they're saying a levy's a levy. Call it a replacement levy, an emergency levy, a renewal levy. A levy's a levy. Your taxes are going up. So that's in there. Also, just recommendations. County commissioners would have more power to reduce property taxes if they feel that the taxing authority has too much money. Good luck with that. So, bottom line.
What's the question?
Are our property taxes going down? Or at least not going up as fast? That's the question.
No, because if the property taxes go down, then all of these organizations are going to go to the state and say, we need more money. And the state is not going to give them any more money because the state is cutting the state income tax and the state is cutting here and there and the state wants to see lower taxes. And so if the property taxes change dramatically, then the state is going to be on the hook for the money because it has to come from somewhere, right?
That deferral program, Jake, would cost the state this year $144 million.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's just an obvious structural problem. If you spend 20 years reducing income tax rates, you're going to be more dependent on property taxes, and those are what's going up. And all the, you know, there's all this like nipping around, this like very technocratic nipping around the edges without addressing that core problem.
With a possible ballot issue in 2026 that would eliminate property taxes completely in the state. Is this going to be enough to satisfy voters who may have to vote on this?
Well, I think that, you know, that we're seeing this property tax initiative gain momentum among a lot of people because people are getting tired of paying property taxes. And the lawmakers will tell you, and it doesn't matter which side of the aisle they're on, ask them what people complain about the most. Property taxes is right up there. A lot of people are getting priced out of their homes. I mean, it's coming down to, can I afford to fund this because I can't afford to stay in my house? And so there is a problem there, but the state has lowered the income tax since 2004, I think it was. They've been lowering this income tax for the past couple of decades, and our income tax now, the highest point, will be 2.5%. And because they've lowered the income tax, there's a lot less money there on that side. So if you change that property tax side, you know, and throw it back to the state, what are they going to do to get the money to fund the schools and fund all those things? Are they going to raise sales taxes? Where does that come from?
I'd add there's $1 billion going to private schools now that's brand new coming out of the budget.
But that's very popular.
But, I mean, I know the system has put too much of a burden, perhaps, on property taxes, Amy. But ultimately, it's us voters who approve higher property taxes with levy.
Right. Well, yeah, when you're faced at the ballot and you're faced with this issue of, like, do I love my metro parks and want them to be as good as they are or better, I'm going to vote yes. Do I want the Adam H. Board or Developmental Disability Board to have the money they need? Then I vote yes. They're appealing to the empathy of the voter. And at some point, there is a breaking point. Is that the circuit breaker? I don't know. but there is a breaking point there. But also, all of these entities that are asking for these property taxes are saying that they need them because their state funding keeps going down year after year, and the cost of everything is going up. I mean, that's what school districts say. It costs more for every teacher, every employee in a school district. You know, they have salaries are increasing. It costs more to educate a child than it ever has before. All the schools need to have more counselors and more mental health training, and there's just more, and it all costs more money. And if the state isn't going to fund that, then they have to ask the homeowners.
Yeah, but levies are. It's not a slam dunk anymore. I mean, levies, I think, especially for schools, the success rate in a lot of places was pretty decent, you know, better than 50-50. Now, property taxes have gone up because home values have gone up. Right. And now, when it'll ask for a levy, it's even more.
But, you know, here's the thing. You're electing the people who are going into the state house. The people out in areas where they're electing Republicans, that they know that they're Republican lawmakers, where they stand on these issues, they're electing them. And I want to make sure to say that when I said that was a 2.75% tax, I need to make that clear, that it's a flat income tax, yep. not progressive anymore.
Yeah, no more.
It used to be.
It's a flat tax. That was the income tax cut that basically the lawmakers passed. Jake, if this gets on the ballot, do we see more urgency on lawmakers to do something more bold than, you know, trying to be more transparent and give deferrals to seniors?
I think if it gets on the ballot, it is too late, and there is a near, I don't want to say 100%, but there is a near 100% chance that it passes.
Really?
In 1912, when Ohio's Constitution was rewritten, you know, we have the right of referendum here. Any citizen can pass, like, marijuana is legal in Ohio because the people wanted it and the people got it. Thank you. Any number of those things, if you don't like a law that lawmakers pass, the citizens have 90 or 180 days to veto it. That power does not exist for tax raises coming out of the General Assembly, because the people who wrote Ohio's Constitution know if you put a question like that on a statewide ballot, people will always vote for lower taxes. It's a certainty. So, like, the idea that in an off-year election, that many people show up and say, no, I like my high property taxes, and I trust my lawmakers to take care of this one.
But think about how that campaign's going to play out. Yes, people hate taxes, and when it push comes to just a black and white world, people will vote for lower taxes. But you're going to have teachers' unions. You're going to have firefighters, police officers, metro parks. You're going to have zoo people saying, We need to fix this problem, but let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
But you're gonna have Facebook, who owns all these data centers, coming out saying, you know what? I don't want to pay property taxes on my 10 data centers. You're gonna have these farmers who own all this land that they're paying property tax on. I mean, I think that there's going to be plenty of money that is perfectly happy watching, and especially a company like Facebook, like they don't have an office here. They're not invested in the community. They're not going to be the ones that deal with crappy schools or police. Sure, they'll take a tax break.
I'm not sure it's going to get on the ballot. There's some question as to whether or not this group really has the money to get it on the ballot, but they have time. They have until what, next summer? About a year from now to get it on the ballot.
Once again, Politics at a Pint was a really fun event. My thanks to Jake Zuckerman from Signal Statewide, Joe Ingles from Ohio Public Radio, and WOSU's Amy Jurevich. We'll have another one of these soon. We will let you know. We'd love to have you join us. We'll be right back.
Sources and Methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
Time now for our Schnelligoster of the Week segment, where we honor the shrewdest politician or political move of the past 7 days. This week, it goes to Governor DeWine's working group on property taxes.
As you heard, they made some modest recommendations which could relieve some people of their property tax burden, but there was really nothing bold in those recommendations. One thing property tax reformers say Ohio must do is reduce the number of taxing jurisdictions in this state. There are thousands of them, hundreds of municipalities, hundreds of school districts, 1,300 townships, scores of developmental disability boards. There are metro parks, there are zoos. But eliminating any of those and consolidating those entities would be very hard politically. But the governor's property tax working group looked at that controversial issue. And what does this working group recommend? It recommends the state form another working group to make recommendations to incentivize efficiencies and sharing resources among government entities. One working group passing the buck to another working group, that's pretty shrewd. And it earns our Snollygoster of the Week award. That will do it for this week's edition of Snollygoster. We are part of the NPR network. As always, please be sure to give us a good review on Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcast, and tell your friends about us. For our digital producer, Michael DeBonis, and our audio engineers this week, Dalton Jones, Holly Rutledge, and Kevin Petrilla, I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster for WOSU Public Media.